Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. A drop of rain and slightly colder again is making it a little bit more like a normal spring here in Ireland. Once again, I'm joined by Adam Woods, Darren Carty and Aidan Brennan to talk all things farming. Later, I'll be joined by our renewables editor, Stephen Robb, to talk about a few questions we got in on the solar investment scheme. As normal, to start, a quick fire questions for Adam, Darren and Aidan. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk at farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Adam, one quick fire in for you. Ask Adam, would he let freshly calved cows out even if there is very little grass? That's as much detail as I have. Adam, talk to me.
Yeah, Jack, I suppose if there's pressure on early calving herds, sometimes in maybe January or February, calving pens can be full and maybe not facilities maybe for cows and calves. So definitely to take pressure off. And look, if grass is tight, I'd say we can in there with some meal maybe or some supplementation. But look, if weather is good at the moment and it's given pretty good for the next few days as well. So if cows and calves got a couple of days of a start at all, they'll be away. I know on Tullamore Farm we have them out and there's no real negatives to having them out down there at the moment.
Good job. Back to you in a minute, Adam. Darren, one quick fire in for you. Let me read it out here to make sure I get it right. I have a question for Darren here. With the sheep price where it is at the moment, I just remembered something I heard Darren say before at a TikTok that Ireland achieved market access to North America in 2021 and still haven't exported any product over there. Will we ever export to the US, or is there some other logistical problem associated with this? Thanks for your time and love the pod, Owen in County Wicklow. Darren, talk to me.
Yeah, Jack, that actually came up at the IFA sheep meeting on Wednesday night as well. James Smith from Irish Country Meats was there and he was asked about it. And he said that they're looking at, say, getting the final steps over the line, that they actually can get some volumes done. But it is frustrating, very frustrating from a farmer point of view that there's no volumes moving there. I think we will get, say, volumes moving this year, but I think it's going to be a niche market. It's not going to solve everything, but any market, any additional market is definitely welcome in the current crisis.
Okay, we'll talk a bit more about markets later on in the show. Darren, Aidan, another quick fire came in on the email for you. This time, another lover of the pod, love the pod. Question for Aidan. I have all my milking platform and support block applied with 2,500 gallons per acre and 23 units of urea per acre. I'm a Cork-based farmer as conditions are unbelievable. Should I follow grazed paddocks with watery slurry? I intend to spread all ground with 1.8 bags of 18-6-12 mid to the end of March. Soils index are 3 for P and K on 90% of the ground. So good fertility, it looks like, Aidan, in the soil and lots of nutrients going out here.
Yeah, Jack, it's a good question, I suppose. Number one, a lot of farmers are asking the same thing, you know, especially those who went early with either slurry or chemical nitrogen, like in this case, when's the next time to go again? For me, I'm in no major panic with it because growth rates are going to be low, soil temperatures are low. You know, it's kind of harsh weather at the moment. Grazing conditions are perfect, but there's not great grass growth. So it's not a real urgency to go again with either slurry or nitrogen again. I'd wait for another probably 10 days, 2 weeks, and then go probably more with the urea rather than slurry or water slurry again. Remember, most of the value in slurry is actually the P and K element of it. So if we get that on the silage ground in April, I think you'd probably be in a better position. It would reduce the, you know, your exposure to having to buy P and K, which is expensive and scarce. So I'd hold off for a while and then I go with urea. 1.8 bags of 18612, it's a heavy enough application. Again, it's costly stuff, you know, and if your soil index is at you know, high and you've already spread the slurry, you probably don't need as much P and K. So he seems to be going, he or she seems to be going a little bit heavy with the P's and K's, whether it's in the slurry or 18612.
Okay, thanks, Aidan. We might touch up that again in the main show later on in terms of soil fertility and soil nutrition and where we're going. Adam, if I come to you first in the main show, it's all about mega finishers for you this week. Maybe just put these numbers that you have in the paper, maybe just put them in context and kind of, how do we feel of these numbers before? Are they completely new?
No, Jack, they're completely new in terms of looking at herds that are finishing animals. So we obtained this information from the Department of Agriculture. We broke them down into different categories of cattle in terms of slaughtered out of the herd. So it's animals over 6 months, so calves are out of it. And we broke them down into 0 to 25, 25 to 50, and up to 1,000. And we've all that detail on the beef pages this week. Really interesting reading here. And just showing, I suppose, the big headline here is there's those 160 herds, Jack, that have finished 413,000 cattle, almost a quarter of the national kill in 2022. And the other big one, I suppose, is the 13,000 less farmers finishing between 0 and 25 cattle. So really, this is a business it's either, you know, getting big to get better. And those 160, I suppose, they're the people that are on contracts, Jack. They're the people that are on forward prices. And they're the people that are around the ring at the moment, I suppose, in terms of giving those big money for cattle, because they know at the other end what they're going to get. So they've a bit of foresight there. Mm. And from a factory point of view, it makes sense, I suppose, as well, as regards getting foresight on what cattle's coming down the line.
And Adam, then, you know, maybe some people look at this as a bad thing, but I mean, is there a positive for those that are selling stores? We'll say, if these mega finishers, we call them, just for want of a better word, if they're around the ring, putting the hand up, keeping price of these stores up, like, I mean, farmers are benefiting from that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Jack. I suppose those 13,000 farmers that have exited, we'll say, slaughtering cattle, we're not saying that those farmers have exited finishing cattle. Those farmers may have opted to go to the mart, and we've been advising that for the last 12 months in terms of, for smaller farmers, there's probably better value in the mart, and let those, when some of those 160 farmers, you know, bid away for those cattle round the ring, and they're probably in a better position to do that. I suppose that's the positive. I suppose the negative is that if I'm in a trading system and I'm competing with these people, these 160 people, they have a great, we'll say, strength in that they know what they can go to around the ring, and they can go to a lot more. And I suppose a smaller finisher that isn't on a contract is getting caught up in that, but he still has to pay, or he or she has to pay that big price for an animal, because they're competing with these other herds to get that. And I suppose the other thing is it right that we're concentrating our whole industry down into a very, very small cohort of farmers? And you might say that they're bidding for cattle around the ring. It's very easy to pull them out of a ring on a mart week in terms of, and maybe jeopardize the trade for that 1 week, or send some fear into the trade. You know, it just, if you concentrate things down into very small, it leads to issues.
So am I getting from you, Adam, it's more about the iniquity of it, and that you have these 160, or maybe there's more, you know, let's say there's 200, let's say there's 500 getting some kind of a contract or some kind of a forward price with the factories. You're saying that, listen, it's playing into the hands of the factories because there's a small number that they can keep tuned up, and they can keep the pipeline full, and they don't have to go near the smaller operators in terms of a forward price. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, that's it. I'd say factories, Jack, took a conscious decision after 2019 in terms of beef protests at factories, the huge issues getting supplies that time. And they said that, look, we need to tighten the net here. We need to close it down into maybe a smaller number of farmers that we're dealing with. That they can, these 160 farmers, you know, finished 2,500 cattle each in 2022. These farmers can turn off the tap or turn on the tap very, very quickly. So in a week where, we'll say last week, where the cattle kill maybe fell 1,400, if that fell more, I suppose some of these farmers could turn on the tap and bring more cattle very, very quickly to the factories. So it leaves them that they can manage supply. Factories as well, on these 160 farms, will have full foresight of what's coming around the corner at them. I suppose the smaller farmer finishing 10 or 15, probably they won't have foresight of those animals coming to them. So it gives the factories maybe more control in terms of managing what's happening there and managing maybe the weekly kill as regards what's coming. And factories would say that gives them a great strength in terms of selling beef and in terms of continuity of supply, that there's no peaks and troughs, that we keep it fairly steady the whole year round.
Okay. Lots more on that in the journal, Adam. Adam, staying with the trade, my suckler buddy was on this week. Like he said, 525 is probably the best he can get for a little bundle of heifers. Like, I mean, where's the trade this week? Is that price more or less where it's at?
Yeah, I'd say so, Jack. A little bit of pressure on there, probably 530, a little bit harder got. Some factories still paying 530 at the beginning of this week, but it's a lot harder got at the end of this week. So you're talking probably in the main 520 for bullocks, 525 for heifers. Factories talking the thing down a lot, you know, talking the price across Europe down. But when I looked around Europe this week, you know, your Italy, U3, Italy bulls are still up at 590. You know, German bulls doing well as well, up at 570. France as well, who we said a lot of beef, up at 572. So the main countries were exporting to, you know, beef is fairly steady. Speaking to Kieran Mealy up north, again, very, very steady up there. Cattle in real demand. So I think this maybe be a short time, maybe a little wobble. I don't think we'll see further, because factories actually have been challenged in getting cattle. Some of them have tried to move to 515, didn't get there, had to come back up to 520 to get bullocks at the beginning of this week. So I think it'll stay steady sort of around that 520, 525. A lot of talk about China. I was speaking to Joe Burke this week, and he said probably it's a little bit tempered over there in terms of demand in China. So we're not seeing a huge lift out of that Brazilian ban yet. We may do so, but his thoughts are that Brazil won't be locked out of China for a long time.
Okay, right. So that's a big one, obviously, in terms of the global trade, like, and could send big signals if they were cut out. Excellent, Adam. Okay, lots more in the journal on the trade as well. Last one, Adam, I'll leave you this, and relates probably to the first question, the quick fire in terms of animal health. Juba, there's a couple of pieces there in a focus this week in terms of animal health. Like, I mean, it's a high priority at the moment in terms of keeping young calves, right? Getting cows and calves out. Like, you've a couple of top tips there, we'll say, in the animal health focus this week.
Yeah, Jack, there's a lot of information in this focus around calves. I took a look at the suckler calves, and it's just about doing the simple things well. And to be honest, in a lot of these farms are part-time, and time is the issue maybe on some of these farms, because you go out in the morning and maybe you're in a rush to get away to work, and you're not taking the time maybe to see there's a calf stretch or to see there's a calf sucking, and maybe it's 6 or 7 o'clock by the time you get back into the yard that evening. So it's a long time if a calf is sick. So just taking that extra bit of time, little bit of organization, making sure you're not pushing the boat out too far in terms of moving cows and calves back out to slats and things like that, and loads of straw, loads and loads of straw, and loads of colostrum. And look at it, if we could get strong colostrum right, we'd eliminate a lot of problems with calves on suckler farms. But a lot more detail in the focus this week.
Okay, 100%. Adam, thanks for that. Chat to you next week. Darren, I was sitting beside a sheep farmer yesterday, and we were talking about students coming on the farm, helping at this time of the year, you know, in terms of the lambing. And he said, geez, he said, we had a student last year, but God, by golly, he said he was hard on straw. He said he was hard on straw. Like, you know, I mean, is it a big problem, straw availability on a lot of the sheep farms?
No, Jack, it's not a problem, I suppose. It's the cost of paying for it. That's probably your problem. Now, I'd actually commend that young student, because that's what he's been told in college, or that's what he's been told at home, or he or she. And like that's I suppose the goal and secret is that, look at straw prevents disease establishing and disease spreading. And like, if you're in a lambing shed at the moment, the more straw you can use, the better. Within reason, obviously. Someone has to pay for that straw too, Jack. Like,
but as far as problems goes with students, Aaron, it's not a real bad one.
it's not a real bad one. No, but just looking at that there, say like for 100-year lambing flock, you'd want a few round bales of straw just for, say, individual lambing pins. That's the sort of thing that you're looking at. And it's no harm, say, a lot of flocks are lambing now. There is straw available. Lots, actually, straw available. Siobhan, he was even saying last week, is there's a lot of straw down her direction in sheds that people didn't sell last year. And that will come out. So I don't think that the availability shouldn't be the one that should be limiting use this year.
Okay, excellent. Darren, the big news this week, I suppose, look, I'll start with the acres job. So like we've talked about this numerous times on the show, the threshold was 30,000 applications. actually 46,000 applications were put in. We got news this week that all 46 are going to be accepted into acres. Like, I mean, were you expecting this?
I was expecting more than the 30,000, Jack, but honestly, I didn't expect 46,000. And like, fair dues to Minister of Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue, that he has said from the beginning that he wanted to exhaust all avenues to get them in. And that he has delivered on that. It, look, there's a couple of knock-on consequences on delays in this opening and delays in maps getting out. But I think if you're any farmer that has got into acres that mightn't have got in and is going to get a payment this year, you're not going to worry too much about a few weeks of delay and maybe getting out your plan or what's in it or that type of thing. I think this, and look, a lot of advisors I talked to this week said that now is where the real work starts, because say the plans are, provisional plans are being put in for the cooperation areas, and that there's a big, big job of work to do over the next 6 months.
The other piece of news that we got, Darren, this week, of course, is the BIS application system is now open for entry. So this is the BIS now that we call it, or the BPS that we called it before, or the single farm payment that we called it maybe before that. Like this, so the green light is there now for Darren, for those that have no complications, I'll say, or that can kind of start making that process. Like just explain to me now that, you know, the flag is up. What exactly can farmers do?
Yeah, so flag is up, Jack, ball is thrown in. So now you can actually get in and start your application. You can complete your application if you're at one of those 46,000, say, acres farmers. Now, they will be able to complete their applications over the next few weeks. And I think, look, if there's one message we can give too, is that if somebody is waiting on acres and goes in and clicks start application and it says this, that you can't proceed because of your acres information is being uploaded. Don't worry about that. Now, you could get the green light tomorrow, Jack, and I might get the green light for 3 weeks because it's going to take time to go through the system. So there's no need to be getting on to your advisor or the department yet, that there'll be time on that. If you're outside of that cohort of farmers, you can now go in and you can say, look at your land parcels. But I think it's important to say that it's a whole new system this year. There's the popular no change, say, application, which over 10,000 farmers would have logged on for the last few years, clicked, I have no changes. It brought them to the in screen. Do you agree to the terms and conditions? Yes. Click submit. Your application is now submitted. That's gone, because every farmer has changed this year. And you're going to have to be, say, reviewing your land parcels to see for space for nature. That is something that is now live. So we talked a lot about, say, checking whether the hedgerows are right, whether the scrub is right, that type of thing. If you go on now and you go into your system, you make changes, that your system is going to, or the department's, say, system, or your portal is going to update live as you do it. When you press save, you're going to get the new estimate. So if you add in a line of new hedgerow, your space for nature estimate should go up. If you take away a line of hedgerow, your space for nature estimate should go down. Okay. So that is now live, and that is something the farmers should now be looking at and making changes.
Just so I'm clear, Darren, are you telling me, so as I log into my agfood.ie, I can actually put in or take out, I have the control, I have the power to put in or take out a hedge on the computer, on the laptop?
Yeah, now there'll be plenty of people that will say, does that give me sanction to take out a hedge? No, there's a difference here between taking it out something that is marked incorrectly and taking out something that you said, Jeannie, I'll whip this out of this now while I have the chance here. Just to be clear on
there now, like,
big difference there, Jack. But no, look, you can go in and you can say, anything that's marked incorrectly or that's omitted, you can go in now and you can say, you can make the changes there. And now, whether that be you yourself or your advisor is approved to act on your behalf. That's something that I would start to get accustomed to, is even looking at the maps, making those changes, see that they come through. Because when you log on now, there's a whole new different, say, portal that comes up ahead of you. Some people have got very accustomed to making their way around, say, the direct payments portal before now. But the first thing you have to go in, so there's different things. You have your space for nature estimate, your GAEC estimates, You have a new stocking rate calculation that will be used for the active farmer check. So that will be down on the left-hand side. That will tell you whether you have, say, you meet the 0.1 livestock units per hectare to satisfy that active farmer check. On the bottom right-hand side, there's a tab for entitlements position. That will tell you what your entitlements position are. Don't be worried when you click into that because it's blank at the moment. The department have said that will be live, or the farmers will be notified in the coming weeks when that goes live around entitlement. So if you're someone that is maybe that has some bits of complications, leasing out entitlements, renting in entitlements, or for a lot of farmers, the fact that scrubland is now deemed eligible, you may not have to say lease out entitlements. So that just I suppose become accustomed to that, but you might have to wait a few weeks to get the exact detail on that. But it's something that I think farmers should be getting accustomed to now and starting to get looking at.
And Darren, while we got news this week again that the extension is going to the end of May, it's no reason not to start straight away in terms of looking at it. Like, I mean, this is going to take a bit of time, like call a spade a spade.
Oh, exactly. I was talking to Chagas advisor yesterday and he said the phone calls have already started. And he said, one fella said, Ginny, you'll call out to me now and you'll see whether my hedges are right or whether they're wrong. And look, at that won't be a runner because calling out to 200 odd applicants. But what you could do to be proactive is possibly ask him about queries that you have on certain maps or this. Ask your advisor, say, is there something that needs that you could be doing that when you go in to make an appointment with your advisor, that it'll make it more streamlined? Do you take the maps that came out and map them just yourself by put hedge beside a hedgerow, or does anything that looks different? So there is different elements like that.
Okay, excellent, Darren. Look at lots there and lots more in the journal, we'll say, on that for farmers to digest. I'll leave you on this one, that just the sheep trade, the sheep price, the sheep protest, Darren. I mean, did I see you got some little bit of a lift in price there this week? Is that going to kind of, I suppose, quell the anger and anxiety that was there over the margin that's left in sheep?
Yeah, look, at any price increase given relative to where we are is welcome. So the price is up 15 to 20 cent a kilo. Base price is now anywhere from 5.95 to 6.10. There will be a bit more demand into next week. Buying for Ramadan, which starts on the 22nd of March, will probably take place towards in the next week, start of the following week, and ramp up then. Early yet to say exactly what indications that'll have on the trade, because there seems to be a lot of finishers holding hoggets, or a lot of people targeting hoggets for that. The demand might be needed, Jack, just to clear the surge of sheep that comes onto the market rather than factories being pressurized into increasing prices more. But what we should see is a lift in demand, and hopefully a lift in demand will translate into higher prices. As you said, look, at a lot of frustration this week. We've seen the ICSA protests on Tuesday. There was another sheep crisis meeting held by the IFA in Wicklow on Wednesday night. I was actually speaking of that one myself, and it's very real concern, Jack. And I think, look, part of the whole area here, it was said to me this week that, Ginny, sure, you've been looking for 30 euros the year for sheep farmers going back years. It didn't come in cap. What's going to change now? And I think that narrative needs to change, because this needs to be separated from the 30 euros per year that we were looking at under cap, to now saying that let's leave aside that 30 euros. What we're looking for now is something that, because sheep farmers are unduly affected because of the circumstances, whether it be COVID, Brexit, and also the war in Ukraine. And that every sector of society has been supported, and also sheep farmers have by other measures, but that now their businesses are unduly affected by the escalation in input costs. And I think that's something that we need to hone in on. Like if we look at just one example of Brexit for the moment, like there's a lot of turmoil, social turmoil in the UK. Figures out this week from an AHDB forecast saying that they expect consumption to be down 8% more relative to 2019 consumption in the UK, which was like big, big figures. And if you take the impact of that related to Brexit, and it now means there is huge quantities of sheep meat going to come onto the European market, well, that's to me, Jack, is definitely a reason to utilize the Brexit adjustment reserve. Like that, yeah. That's what that is there for. But yes, yeah, yet we're not talking about this.
I hear you. Like, yeah, what you were saying is like, let the, whatever subvention is going to come now, let it be market related rather than kind of just that the 30 euros per euro that was kind of, as you say, always talked about. So yeah, related to the problem, for the core problem at the moment. Excellent, Darren, listen, 100%, thanks for that. Lots more on the sheep trade, and I suppose that'd be the big one this week, the base and start up and the acre start up. Lots more on that in the journal this week. Thanks for that, and we'll chat to you again next week. Folks, later in the show, I'll talk to Stephen Robber, Renewables editor, on the solar job. I mean, Aidan, there's a lot of dairy farmers that are considering solar, and especially with this new TAMS piece. The TAMS piece I wanted just to touch off you was in terms of that limit that's on in terms of the milking equipment. So we've got news this week, and I see a story there in the journal that, it, you know, the 120 cow limit, it's there, it's real.
Yeah, Jack, 120 cows is the most you can have you to commit to if you want to draw down the TAMS funding for milking equipment, which includes, yeah, you know, milking units in a herringbone parlour or our dairy robot, milking robot. So the exceptions to that, Jack, if you're in a partnership, you can go up to 160 cows. So there's more allowed in that situation. But so yeah, it's a severe restriction on a lot of people. We spoke about it last week as well, Jack, that this was coming, yeah, you know. So
yeah,
it hasn't been well received, and it's tough on farmers that, you know, maybe have more cows than that and need to improve They're milking, yeah, facilities, and that's what TAMS is there for, in my view. So it's yeah, hard to swallow that it's, you know, you're now limited. You can't draw down that funding for milking equipment.
Yeah, and just to be clear, Aidan, like there's I don't know, there's 400 odd items in the TAMS listing. This limit specifically comes back to the milking equipment, so the robot or the herringbone parlor, as you say. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And look, I mean, We were complimentary of TAMS in terms of the fact that it's giving, you know, the poultry, pig producers are now benefiting from TAMS. But I mean, there's no limit on how many pigs you can have. There's no limit on how many horses you can have to draw down the TAMS funding for arenas and whatever else. So it's confusing to me why dairy farmers have been targeted with a note per limit in terms of how much stock they can have, when no other sector of Irish agriculture is held to the same account.
Yeah, and you were saying it's a big one for your guys, the milking piece. And again, I suppose, Aidan, I see a feature. You have a feature there this week in terms of milking frequency. Like your feature is about reducing the number of milkings, is it? Just give us a quick flavor for that.
Yeah, so I was down in Moorpark the other day, and they did a study. So they've been doing studies on once a day milking for the last 3 or 4 years, and last year then they tweaked it to looking at 10 and 7 milkings as opposed to flat once-a-day milking. And I suppose really, Jack, the results are 10
and
very
7
positive.
Days, is it?
Yeah, sorry, 10 milkings in 7 days. So you'd milk twice a day, 3 days a week, and you'd milk once a day, 4 days a week. And the 4 days would include the weekend. So every Saturday and Sunday is a once-a-day day. And then you'd be once a day on a Tuesday and a Thursday as well. And you'd be twice a day, you know, Monday, Wednesday and Friday. So really, I suppose, is to make it more socially acceptable, really, Jack, that your weekends are shorter working days.
Is it done at this time of the year? Sorry, you know, in terms of freshly calved cows, lots of milk, was it carried out at this time?
So the three treatments on it, the control treatment, which is milk twice a day all year round. They had a full-time one, 10 and 7, which was 10 and 7 from the start of lactation until the end of lactation. And then the second one then was looking at it part-time. So they went 10 and 7 from the 4th of July, which is more or less halfway through the season. So from the 4th of July on, they went 10 and 7. And they found no reduction in milk solids performance per cow in the 10 and 7 from the part-time versus the twice-a-day all season. They found an 11% reduction in milk solids per cow in the all season 10 and 7 compared to the twice-a-day treatment. So, okay. And go back, Jack, to the once-a-day, they found a 21% reduction in milk solids from all season once-a-day compared to all season twice-a-day. So okay, for three extra milkings per week, you can reduce that 21% down to 11% based on these results now. Look, I mean, it's for me, it's good, but it needs to be replicated. So they're going to do it again next year, this season, to see what impact it's going to have. You know, can they replicate those results? Okay. But it's a big reduction in milkings, Jack, you know, which can't be ignored.
Four milkings. Am I right? Four milkings. You're skipping four milkings of the 14, like in the week.
Yes. Yeah. But those milkings are, you know, two. You can do whatever days you want. But, well, sorry, it has to be, like, it's timed. The milking times are changed to say, limit the impact. So on the once-a-day days, they're not milking until 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And then on Sunday, then it's actually a little bit earlier. It's 8 o'clock, and it's 10 o'clock, I think, on a Saturday that the milkings are. Okay. So they tweak the times in order to minimize the impact in terms of milk being in the cow for so long. So it's not going to, you know, from animal welfare point of view. And also, if the cow was in milk for a longer period, she's more likely to lose production as a result of that. Yes. So it's big in New Zealand, Jack. There's lots of herds doing it, and I think it's something we're going to see more of in time to come.
Aidan, did you say 10 or 11%? So, like, let's say a cow is producing 500 kilos of milk solids. So, 50 kilos, you're losing 50 kilos of milk solids for skipping four out of the 14 milkings. Like, it's not bad. Like, I mean, the return is probably, if you know, the return on investment is good, or, the you know, depending on what you do with your
family. But it's even better, Jack, if you do, you know, if you milk twice a day for the first half, twice a day every day for the first half of the season, and then go 10 and 7 for the, like, there's no difference.
Yeah. No.
Found.
And it's a complete no-brainer. Like,
I see Palaskenry were on to me there. They did it last year from July on. I think they had an All-Ireland final in Limerick and they couldn't get milkers. So they went 10 and 7, and they said they found no reduction either. Of course, the difference there is that's a commercial herd and you're comparing one year against another year. So who knows what the production would be if they're twice a day. Mm. And I suppose that's criticism of some of the stuff coming out of New Zealand, is that it's all based on commercial herds. So you're not, there's no controlled experiment like there is in Moorpark on it. So I suppose really it highlights the importance of, when you're looking at research, you know, is there a controlled experiment there? Can you compare like with like? And that's the advantage, I suppose, of what Moorpark are doing, albeit with small numbers, 21 cows in a treatment, so it's small.
Yeah.
How do you overcome that is by replicating it over a number of years to make sure you're improving the quality of the data that's in the research. So it's positive to see that.
Okay. And obviously production is only one aspect of it. There's lots of other welfare issues, milk quality issues, you know.
And cell count was higher, you know, it has to be acknowledged. I think it was, from memory now, it was around 130 or 140 for the twice-a-day group, and it was pushing 200 for the 10 and 7 all season. So there is impacts there on cell count. And the other thing to say as well, Jack, I've written in the paper this week, is that for maybe owner-operators who are doing most of the milkings themselves, you know, the feedback I get is that they are not inclined to milk later on the once-a-day days. They'd rather have, you know, milk at is whatever, you know, 5, 6, 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, whatever time they normally milk at in the mornings. And then they have the day to themselves to carry out whatever tasks are needed. For them to have to milk at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, those milkings being a little bit longer, it's, you know, it doesn't suit them really. So maybe it's more suitable to a farm that's predominantly a labor, you know, hired labor type of system, which is much more attractive in that case.
Yeah, excellent. Very interesting. No doubt we'll come to it again. Aidan, like, I mean, it's fair to say, like, very busy time, but on dairy farms, but the weather is really playing into your hands, isn't it? And again, looking at the forecast, like, there's not a whole lot of rain in the forecast for the next week. Like, you're probably going to even start looking for a drop zone.
Yeah, Jack, I'd be at this stage now, I'd be nearly more inclined to see a bit of mildness coming in. And if that brought rain with it, so be it, kind of, you know, which is unusual to say, but... Look, it is very good. Can't deny that. There's a problem going to come, though, and we're not going to have enough grass to keep us going until the second rotation. That's just a reality. So you need to accept that. Now, I'm writing in the paper this week, and Martin Murray is doing the same in the grass page, that we need to slow down the rotation length for the majority of farmers, not everyone now, you know. But if you've gone out grazing early, you know, late January, early February, you've been out twice a day since, the likelihood is that you're up to 40, 50%. I was talking to a man the other day who was at 60%, over 60% of the farm graze now. We've all a March to go, and we've a share of April to go yet before we're going to go back into those first graze paddocks. And it's much worse on the cow and on the system to be feeding an off that of silage at the end of March compared to feeding some silage at the start of March. Because cows at that time, you know, you're only weeks away from breeding. They should be on a rising plane of nutrition. They should be hitting peak production, you know, heading into peak production. And if you're putting in a load of silage then, or a load of poor quality feed, no matter how good the silage is, it's still poorer than grass. So I'd say be cautious now. If you need to put in extra feed, do it now. Slow down the rotation length and budget, you know, every day from now on until probably the 5th or 6th of April in most cases. Okay, grand, situation could change very quickly and it might get very wet and we might have to house full time for a week in March. And maybe some farmers are hoping that's going to happen. But look at the forecast, Jack. You wouldn't bet in it. So I think, you know, being proactive now will probably be a better bet in order to make sure that you'll avoid having to put in a load of feed later on in the month.
Okay, excellent. No, good advice and good chat on that. I leave you on this, and it comes back to Bill's query at the start in terms of fertilizer. Like, I mean, most guys have gone, looking around the fields as you're driving, most guys have gone with the first split of urea. It's the second split. The questions are coming in around the second split, I suppose. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is, Jack. And, you know, I suppose a lot, because the weather is so good and people have a bit more time on their hands this spring compared to other springs, because it's going quite well. Cows are grazing, they have more time on their hands. They're maybe thinking of going spreading with the urea now. For me, I'm in no major panic. Look, if you went in the last days of January, fair enough, any time now in the next 10 days, go with your second split. But because growth isn't great, the uptake won't be super. So for me, there's no real rush on getting it out there. Look, it won't be lost, but it won't probably do much for you either. So I'm in no major panic with it. In other situations where no nitrogen has been spread to date, by all means, definitely go with it and probably go a bit stronger than the half bag. I'd be up 30 units probably at this stage on feeds that didn't get slurry. Look, a lot of ground has got slurry. But as I said at the intro, it's the most of the value in the slurry is the P and K element of it, not necessarily the nitrogen. So if you can hold, if the capacity of the whole slurry in tanks until you're going with silage ground that need P and K most, or low P and K soil fertility fields, I'd be inclined to do that and go with the chemical nitrogen now on fields that don't need slurry.
Excellent, 100%. Caden, thanks for that. Chat to you next week. Folks, earlier, as I said, I had a chat with Stephen Robber, Renewables editor, about all things solar. Let's have a listen. Folks, now I'm joined by Stephen Robb, our Renewables editor. Stephen, thanks for coming on the show. We had a good few queries in, I suppose, all related to TAMS, all related to solar. So I said, what better man to get to answer these questions than Stephen Robb? The first one, Stephen, and there's a good few questions in this, like if I can read them out so that I get them right. Hello, can you tell us about TAMS, please? I am interested in solar. I understand that you need to size the solar for your own use by making us do an energy audit of some kind. I have yet to figure out how to do this, but my question is, if and when we export a small amount on a sunny day, will we get paid for it? That's the first part, Stephen. Maybe we'll just have a peep at that first and get a little bit of talk around that. First, this energy audit piece, I suppose, and then we come to the export piece. Just talk to us around that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jackie's spot on. It was actually the same as the last TAMS 2, and that's been carried over now to TAMS 3, or specifically the Solar Capital Investment Scheme, which is a 60% grant on a solar PV system. So basically, you will have to complete a solar PV survey before you can submit an application. In fact, the survey has to be submitted along with the application. And the whole idea of that is to break down and document, I suppose, your farm's electricity usage over the past 12 months, really, is the period. That can be got from the bills. Depending on, I think we've all become a lot more aware of our bills over the past 12 months. So if anything, that job should be a little bit easier. The department asks for a yearly figure, then they want a monthly figure, and then they want an average daily figure as well, I think it is. Why do they ask for this figure? Well, really, you have to then prove that the size of the solar PV system, which you want to get a 60% grant aid on, the output from that system will match your farm's electricity demand. And if you like, that's how they're going to stop you from getting a 6% grant on a solar panel system and exporting it all to the grid. You can't do that because they're not going to allow you to install a larger system than what you really need.
Okay. And Stephen, who does this for the farmer? Like, can you do it yourself? Who do you need to engage to kind of get that energy audit done?
Yeah, look, the energy audit itself sounds scarier than what it is. You know, if you have your electricity bills there, you can do it yourself. You would want 12 months worth of bills to get the figures that's needed. Anyone who is looking at solar panels, or anyone who's investing in solar panels at the moment, has probably engaged with a number of solar PV suppliers at this stage. The first thing a solar PV supplier is going to ask for is for a copy of your bills. And if they're worth their salt at all, they will go off and try and match the system that they're trying to sell you to what your farm actually needs, because they know that that's a requirement of TAMS. They might size it a little bit bigger. You might get away of sizing it a little bit bigger, but it's not going to be excessive. So chances are, Jack, by the time you go to submit a TAMS application, you will have actually had two or three quotes with most of that information on it already. To come to the second part of that question, can you export it to the grid?
Export.
Yeah, you can. You always could. You were never actually limited. You never physically, you couldn't not export to the grid. It's only recently that the government introduced legislation to make it mandatory that you could get paid for it as such. Now, that was kind of standard across Europe at that stage, and Europe was forcing us to do it. So they didn't just do it for the good of their health. I guess the department can't physically stop you from exporting to the grid. You'd have to have a certain type of electricity or ESB connection to allow you to do that. And I don't know of anyone who's done that or anyone who has that. Where they can limit you is the size of the solar PV system that you can install. So you physically won't have much excess electricity to export to the grid. But look, as we've spoken about before, Jack, exporting to the grid is your last resort. You don't want to export to the grid. You want to use all of your electricity on site as best you can, because that's where you get the most value for it.
Okay, that's the efficiency. Excellent. Stephen, I'll stay going on this question. Must I wait to get approved before putting the system in? Must I wait to get approved before putting the system in?
Yeah, no, you do. Similar to I suppose, most TAMS applications, you'll need approval, so you will. But again, you'll be ready to go by the time you get approval.
Okay. And then the second part of that question, any idea how long approval will take?
Oh, look, that's something that we don't know at the moment. So the trade and the industry are expecting a flood of applications, because most guys, especially on the second half of last year, whenever people realized that the 60% grant aid was coming, they held off. They held off on investing. So they have the quotes, they have the system sized, they might even have it ordered. So they're ready to go. So I would be expecting that certainly for the first tranche anyway, there's going to be a flood of applications. So how quickly will they be able to process them, Jack? We're just not sure yet.
Okay, excellent. So great questions there from Adrian in on the email. I mean, Stephen, I leave you on this. Like, I mean, are you, you know, given what you know about this, and I see you've a nice feature in the journal again on it this week, like, I mean, given what you know, I mean, this makes sense for a lot of farms, does it? In, you know, not only dairy farms that maybe have a higher energy usage, we'll say, than some of the dry stock farms or the tillage farms, but does it make sense for all farms?
Jack, we're about to get a 60% grant on a solar PV and battery system. No other industry in Ireland, no other industry in probably the world, to be honest, will have that. So they want, it is a phenomenal grant, and it's a phenomenal opportunity for pretty much all farmers. Now, where it doesn't really make sense is where you have an out farm, maybe a dry stock farm or a tillage, grain store or whatever. We have really bugger all demand. The vast majority of farms, some size of a system will still make sense, especially now that the farmhouse, providing it's on the same meter as the farm, can be included in that solar PV survey. So, you know, not only are we getting a 60% grant on the farm, the farm's electricity usage, but you're also getting it on the house, so long as you're on the same meter. Like, no one else has that. So yes, Jack, it makes absolute sense. So it does. There's a fair bit to it. There's a fair bit to the application process, as we've detailed in the Farmers Journal this week on the renewables page, because it is a fixed structure. And anyone who has, you know, built a shed through TAMS or any other kind of a fixed investment structure through TAMS knows kind of there's a fair bit to it. It's quite rigorous. There's various maps and reports that need to be done. But look, I suppose there really is no such thing as a free lunch. So I think we'll just have to grin and bear it.
Okay, Stephen, really, really, last question now. In terms of, if I am a farmer, I've been hearing about this for a long time, what's my first step here in terms of, do I contact some of the commercial companies, or is there some other middle place I need to go? Like, who do I contact first to kind of get an idea in terms of my cost, get an idea in terms of the energy audit piece, et cetera?
Yeah, look, well, apart from reading the Farmer's Journal, obviously, Jack, look, I suppose first place, get your bills, look at your electricity usage, have that all to hand. And what a lot of guys are doing is they are going out to 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe different solar PV providers. And there is a lot of them, and they are independent, and there is a bit of a variation in price and level of service, to be perfectly honest with you. And that's how guys are kind of understanding, I suppose, what's the best system for them. Yeah, look, there is information there in the SEEI on Chagas. The IFA have partnered, well, they've been partnered with Bord Gáis, so if you could go through them, it's the same thing as going through another commercial provider. But really, that's how guys are kind of getting a handle on this, Jack.
Okay, excellent. Stephen, great information. Great to have you on the show. Chat again soon. Right, folks, thanks to Steve and Rob for that chat on the solar job. That's it for another week. Thanks for watching, and indeed, thanks for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists, Adam, Darren and Aidan. Remember, you can listen back to any of the recent webinars or podcasts on ifj.ie/podcast. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.